Rick Moody's stories are full of men and women trying to get by in life, sometimes struggling, sometimes thriving, sometimes standing still. If you've read the novel or seen the movie The Ice Storm, you know something of Rick Moody's work. In that story, the characters are disaffected 1970s suburbanites, hurting themselves and each other, seemingly without care. But Moody manages to take us beneath the surface, revealing people who desperately want to make sense of their lives. In his new collection of stories, called Demonology, Rick Moody often writes about grief. He uses rhythmic language and non-traditional narrative to immerse readers in the complicated world of loss.
I don't think grief is shapely. You know, it doesn't happen in an orderly way. So instead of just saying, gee, it would be great if I could just allow you to read the story and send you on your way, I'd rather that you really know what it's like, what it feels like, and thus to experience the complexities of loss.
Rick Moody's latest collection begins with the story of Andrew Wakefield, who's nearing 30 and drifting through life after the death of his sister. Andrew quits his job at a fast food chicken joint to work at a giant wedding hall in upstate New York. Here's Rick Moody reading from that story, The Mansion on the Hill.
Let me take a moment to describe our core business at the Mansion on the Hill. We were in the business of helping people celebrate the best days of their lives. We were in the business of spreading joy by any means necessary. We were in the business of paring away the calluses of woe and grief to reveal the bright light of commitment. We were in the business of producing flawless memories. We had 7 auditoriums, or marriage suites, as we like to call them, each with a slightly different flavor and decorating vocabulary. For example, there was the Chestnut Suite, the least expensive of our rental suites, which had lightweight aluminum folding chairs with polyurethane padding and a very basic altar table, which had the unfortunate pink and lavender floral wallpaper and which seated about 125 comfortably. Then there was the Hudson Suite, which had some teak in it and a lot of paneling and a classic iron altar table and some rather large standing tables at the rear. And the dining stations in Hudson were clothed all in vinyl instead of the paper coverings that they used in Chestnut. Then there was the Rip Van Winkle room with its abundance of draperies, its silk curtains, its matching maroon settings of inexpensive linen, and the Adirondack suite, the Ticonderoga room, the Valentine room, a sort of giant powder puff, and of course the Niagara Hall, which was grand and reserved with its separate kitchen and its enormous fireplace and white-gloved staff, for the sons and daughters of those Victorians of Saratoga County who came upstate for the summer during the racing season, the children of contemporary robber barons, the children whose noses were always straight and whose luck was always good.
When I read that, it makes me laugh. I mean, I kind of, even though I feel kind of snide for doing it at the same time, but there is a playful streak in there. But you get to the end about the children whose noses were always straight and whose luck was always good. And it's a pretty pointed barb. You're not just being playful in that paragraph.
Well, see, I think of it as being a contrast between the narrator's economic difficulties and that kind of longing that he experiences on looking kind of over the fence at the rich kids of the county getting married in these beautiful big wedding halls. You know, when the story opens, he's been reduced to being the guy who walks back and forth in front of a barbecued chicken restaurant wearing a chicken mask and advertising, you know, wings for $4.59 and stuff. So it's a little bit of that kind of desperate, poignant longing that the fiscally challenged have when confronted with the people whose luck has always been good.
Are there ever points where you feel, I mean, here you are creating these characters, you have to feel some sympathy for them, but are there ever times when you think, this person is a jerk, I can't go on writing about this person?
No, actually, on the contrary, I love them. I love them. And the difficulty is that I love people who most people would cross the street to avoid. But I love
that
them
bad,
anyway.
Huh?
I love them anyway. I mean, sometimes the weirder they get, the better I like them. And it's really because I think literature does its thing best when it's giving voice to people who are unrepresented, who don't have a vote, kind of, you know. Because we all know the CEOs or the high-functioning, good citizens of our village. We know them, you know, and we sort of know that their lives are somewhat comfortable and sort of proceed in an orderly fashion. It doesn't make for good drama. And furthermore, You know, I just want to make sure that those other people get a voice someplace.
You also do a story called Wilkie Fahnestock, the boxed set. I'm going to try and describe it for listeners. On the page, it's not just printed type. It's not just paragraphs. It's this box. It's got a frame around it, a box. And the box, imagine there are two columns. There's a line right down the middle. So on the left-hand side, we have a story going on. And on the right-hand side, we have all the songs in Willie Fahnestock's life, or in a big chunk of his life. You know, from the Bee Gees to Dire Straits, I don't even remember all the different songs, to Al Green, you name it, all these songs that go through his life. So you're reading kind of like two columns at the same time and trying to keep track of what's going on. It's cute, it's fun, it's interesting, it's unusual, but why do it?
You know, since I've never read the story, not knowing what it's about, I'm just really interested to hear you say how you read it, going back and forth from one column to the other, because I never really knew how people tried to read it before. You know, that story is self-evidently light and not emotionally a big challenge. And part of the idea here is that, you know, this book begins with a grief-stricken narrator, and the book ends with a story about a grief-stricken narrator. I wanted to make sure there were stories in the middle of the book that were just funny and light so that people wouldn't feel like, you know, this was like a Bergman film or something. There would be moments of levity so that the beginning and the end would seem, you know, more valuable somehow, not impossible to get through or something.
Well, I actually read the Willie Fahnestock, the boxed set story with this funny diagram. I took it as a parody of all these people who have their own personal websites now, you know, johndoeme.com or, you know, whatever, Jane Doe. Come to my website and read all about me and all the things I like to do in my life. What? I don't know if that was in your head or not.
Yeah, well, it was sort of written before the website thing was as big as it is now, but it's the same idea. I mean, I wanted to say, look, this guy's not of particular interest. What's of interest here is just that it's possible these days to tell a biography through the artifacts of someone's life, their record collection. I wrote a story when I was younger that was just a bibliography. So, you know, it's possible to say in America who someone is based on what books they like or what records they like.
Has that not always been the case, except for the fact that the technology has changed? But hasn't it always can't we etch characters by looking at their artifacts or studying their artifacts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would have been true before, but since the technology's changed, it's a lot easier. And frankly, I started writing these stories when it became easier to make a story look like that on the page. You know, when you had your IBM Selectric 2, to try and write this story would have been really hard.
So it's a computer story at the same, just by the mere fact of its generation.
Yeah, it's a Microsoft Word story.
You do have a pretty varied cast of characters, but people still associate you, because of the ice storm, I would imagine, with writing about this kind of deep, unsettling dissatisfaction that suburbanites has. Is that, do you look at that? Do you observe that dissatisfaction?
Well, it's true that it's my reputation because of that book. You know, I don't want to get pigeonholed. I don't want to be just one writer. And I think for people who haven't read some of my other books, they might be surprised to realize that there's a little more range than just the suburban stuff. I mean, it happens. I know a lot about the suburbs. I grew up there. And the interesting thing for me is that the suburbs have this reputation for being sort of pristine and free of the difficulties of the city or, you know, very rural communities and so forth. And I think that reputation is undeserved, you know, that frankly the same difficulties obtain. And that's what's exciting to me, the difference between perception and reality in a suburban landscape.
I can't help but ask about the rhythm of language. I'm thinking very specifically of even though I hate to give away the end of a story, I'm going to break that rule now, because the last paragraph of Demonology itself, would you read that last paragraph?
I'll do my best. I should fictionalize it more. I should conceal myself. I should consider the responsibilities of characterization. I should conflate her two children into one, or reverse their genders, or otherwise alter them. I should make her boyfriend a husband. I should explicate all the tributaries of my extended family, its remarriages, its internecine politics. I should novelize the whole thing. I should make it multi-generational. I should work in my forefathers, stonemasons and newspaper men. I should let artifice create an elegant surface. I should make the events orderly. I should wait and write about it later. I should wait until I'm not angry. I shouldn't clutter a narrative with fragments, with mere recollections of good times, or with regrets. I should make Meredith's death shapely and persuasive, not blunt and disjunctive. I shouldn't have to think the unthinkable. I shouldn't have to suffer. I should address her here directly. These are the ways I miss you. I should write only of affection. I should make our travels in this earthly landscape safe and secure. I should have a better ending. I shouldn't say her life was short and often sad, and I shouldn't say she had her demons, as I do too.
I did read a quote where you said, I think literature has the power to save lives or change lives?
I said I wanted to save lives. I want literature to save lives, you know. I mean, we think of it as like the thing you read on the subway now or the plane or something, you know? But I think that it can do that. It can have that value. It can be as important as the best film you ever saw in your life, or more important than your favorite song, you know? It can be like Milton or Plato or something. I'm not saying I'm there, but it's a good ambition to have.
Rick Moody, his latest collection of short stories is called Demonology. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Lisa.